This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. What if you call 911 and no one comes? That's a problem facing several towns in northern Wisconsin after they lost their ambulance service provider at the beginning of this year. Towns are mandated to provide emergency services unless they're offered elsewhere. But as Danielle Kading reports, rural communities are struggling to provide that service because of a lack of volunteers, long distances, and inadequate financing.
Bud Rubeck never saw him coming. He and his wife Julie had gone over to a neighbor's house late one night in Clam Lake to try to smooth things over between a fighting couple. Instead, the man blindsided him, punching Rubeck on the left side of his head. He fell and hit the ground hard.
When the ambulance service got here, had we not had critical care paramedics, I would have been dead.
Great Divide Ambulance Service and Cable was there to respond when his life was on the line. Paramedics took him to Cable, where they were met by a helicopter. He was flown to a hospital in Duluth, where he spent several days on life support. He left after a month and had to learn to walk all over again. But now if someone dials 911 in Clam Lake, he says there's no guarantee anyone will answer.
We're on our own.
Clam Lake recently lost its ambulance service after Great Divide decided not to renew contracts with six towns in Ashland County. Some have found service, but several others have not. Great Divide's Rob Poles says the ambulance service struggled with overtime costs and other mounting expenses, but the biggest issue was staffing.
And in a pandemic situation, there aren't people lining up to be first responders right now.
The town of Gordon is one of the places left in the lurch. Chairman Doug Thorpe asked every surrounding agency if they would contract to respond, but they all pointed to a lack of staff or the distance. It could take some up to 45 minutes to respond one way.
That just leaves us kind of in the middle of the woods with no ambulance service.
While services like Great Divide pay staff, more than 90% of Wisconsin fire departments rely on volunteers like Mellon Fire and Rescue. The fire and ambulance outfit is nearby towns that lost service. But Fire Chief Tony Huber says they may not be able to answer every call because they have a small staff of just under a dozen volunteers.
The younger generation does not want to do this stuff. You look up here in northern Wisconsin, there's not a lot of younger people sticking around for one thing.
Like many rural areas, northern Wisconsin has a shrinking and aging population that makes it difficult to find volunteers. Gordon and other towns reached out to the Ashland Fire Department last fall. Ashland has the closest service with a paid staff.
Most of them are gone right now. We have had a terribly busy day today.
That's Fire Chief David Wegener. On the day we meet up, he says they had five calls in about 20 minutes. One ambulance was just returning from transferring a patient to the hospital. Wegener says they have to weigh their call volume and staffing when they get requests to provide service. He says they're now responding to one nearby town that lost service, but that doesn't make sense for communities farther away.
And when you take into account weather conditions on the roads and such, not only does that place the patient at risk, but it places our staff at risk as well.
Long distances increase the need for highly skilled staff that can provide critical care in the field. But Thorpe and Huber say the necessary training and testing are barriers for volunteers. They think the state should ease a testing requirement for first responders to get certified. Republican lawmakers have reintroduced a bill to do just that. But John Ike, who directs the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health, fears that pits the need for volunteers against patient care.
People are only doing this because they're feeling desperate. And this is why we need to address this with more serious solutions.
Ike and others think state or local governments should pay people to respond, rather than relying on volunteers. But town officials argue their ability to raise revenue is limited. Bud Rubeck doesn't know the best solution, but he hopes to see one soon, as the COVID-19 virus remains a risk for older residents.
With everything that's going on, I just think it's important that we get this figured out
before the next time someone dials 911. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to The Morning Show. The coronavirus that causes COVID-19 emerged just more than a year ago, and scientists are working furiously to help us understand what its existence means for our communities long term. An issue impossible to avoid in its effect is education. We're talking with a doctor whose research is cited by the CDC as it pushes out information about safely opening schools to in-person learning without worsening a devastating and deadly pandemic. What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1061. 1234. What are you wondering about children or asymptomatic spread of COVID-19? What have you experienced? Do you have a child who's gone back to school? Do you have one who is still learning remotely? What do you see and what do you wonder? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Dr. Amy Falk. She's a pediatrician at Aspirus Doctors Clinic in Wisconsin Rapids. Dr. Falk, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. You released a study at the end of January, which was published by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, that found encouraging results when it came to COVID-19 spread in schools in the central Wisconsin area. What did you find?
We were, I've been involved with the school districts here in Southwood County since the beginning of the early planning stages in the summer 2020, as most of the schools here wanted to go back in person in some capacity. And I was just a consultatory role to help them, guide them in the best evidence-based way possible. And when we were sort of watching masking compliance as school went on, as well as the case rates, we found that there was despite really rampant community spread we had here in Southwood County at that time, we really found over the 13 weeks that there was very minimal cases of COVID-19 in the schools. We found 191 cases between students and staff during the 13-week time frame. And of those, only 7 cases were thought to be contracted within the school. And all of those were students. There was no teachers who, based on contact tracing, were thought to have contracted COVID-19 in the school setting.
Which is interesting because earlier this week, the CDC put out information citing a study in elementary schools in Georgia where mask use and social distancing were sometimes inadequate. And that points to the idea that teachers may play an important role in the transmission of COVID-19 in schools. What do you make of that?
Yeah, and I think that echoes pretty well what we've kind of discovered over the past couple of months. There's been some other studies released, including a very large study looking at how well people of different age groups transmit COVID-19. And it seems that children between the ages of 0 to 19 really don't transmit the virus to many people. Like on a large scale, they just really aren't responsible for significant spread. They're not super spreaders. The age group that does that is generally like 20 to 50 is what they had cited. And so I think that points to the fact that adults really do seem to drive this. And if teachers really take on really great masking and distancing the best that they are able, the students really don't seem to be a source of infection, unlike many other viruses that we know. As a pediatrician, we know that there are many types of viruses that are that children do propagate quite readily, and this just doesn't seem to be one of them.
So when you're looking at your numbers and other studies, what is the real takeaway from that low transmission rate after you analyze the data?
I think it's important to recognize, I mean, every school system is very different. Every community, I think, in a mental place is in a very different place. But what we found echoes what Duke found with a very large study in other places around the country and the world, that schools are really a safe place to be with mitigation measures such as masking. Distancing really wasn't perfect at these schools. We didn't publish that data, but it really was quite variable as far as what students and staff were maintaining. And I think it just shows that with appropriate mitigation measures like hand washing and masking and some level of distancing, that that schools really are a safe and important place for children to be.
We're talking with Dr. Amy Falk, who's a pediatrician in Wisconsin, and we're talking about a study she did about transmission of COVID-19 in schools and the broader picture here with the doctor. And we've got Ethan in Madison who gave us a call. Hi, Ethan.
Hi. Yeah, I was just curious if in your study you looked at infections of people within the students' homes and whether or not you were regularly testing students or just waiting until they're symptomatic to go to the testing route.
Ethan, thanks for both of those questions. Let's start with the first one, and that's how are you contact tracing and figuring out if students got the virus from home or someplace else, and how can you confirm or deny that it happened through school?
And yeah, that's a great limitation of ours. That's a big limitation of our study and many other studies during the time frame that, you know, from end of August, beginning of September through November, testing capacity was really not there in many settings. And so it really relied on school administrators, teachers, and public health department contact tracing. So that's just obviously extensive questioning, trying to figure out where the kid was, and through their investigations, as was occurring in much of the country at that time, that these cases, the other cases aside from the seven that were thought to have occurred within the school, were traced back in some way to either an adult household contact who had COVID-19 prior that fit the kind of the window of infection, or some other activities such as extracurriculars. And so regarding your point on some asymptomatic surveillance, no, that was not being done during that time frame. But we are, I am helping the schools initiate asymptomatic surveillance that actually started on Monday here at our middle and high school, the large middle and high school in Wisconsin Rapids. And so we will be hopefully surveilling approximately 20% of the student and staff body based on volunteers, and just to see what the asymptomatic rate is in the school. I think a lot of people fear that the asymptomatic rate is high, but there's some really good postulations that perhaps it is not a high number and you would expect to see more symptomatic people in those age ranges. So we'll see what that shows.
We've had many doctors on the Ideas Network come on and say asymptomatic spread is absolutely a driving factor in the spread of COVID-19. I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. Are you saying specifically that asymptomatic spread might be less likely in a certain range of schools? Are you saying it's less likely than we have believed so far?
I think so. Asymptomatic spread is thought to be a major driver, but my point was in the school setting, one would expect that if there was a large asymptomatic rate, you would expect more symptomatic people, especially in a school setting where people are closer together, perhaps, than out in the community, with, you know, kind of more contact there in some cases. And so I think, and that's just not been well described. And so that's what we're hoping to get at based on, you know, the asymptomatic rate. We've done testing for several days, and right now we've found zero asymptomatic cases. And obviously that's 2 days of data. So it's going to take a few weeks for us to figure out what's going on in that capacity. But again, there's really not, there's not robust data on that within the school setting specifically.
Dr. Amy Falk released a study that found very low coronavirus transmission rates within 17 schools in central Wisconsin. We're talking about what that means and what the limits are of case studies like this, especially right now. Still time for you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how schools and students and teachers can hold in-person classes safely? What mitigation measures do you see happening in your districts that you think are working or maybe not? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. National health experts say schools can be safe places for students to learn despite a pandemic. A study out of Wisconsin indicates things like mask wearing in schools created an environment that didn't spawn as many symptomatic cases of COVID-19 as were spreading in the community. It's one piece of science that we're using to understand what we should do next as the coronavirus remains a threat. We're talking about this with the doctor who ran the study here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Our guest is Dr. Amy Falk. And here on the Ideas Network, we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. We've got Julie in Wisconsin Dells ready to talk with us. Hey, Julie.
Hello. Yes, I'd like to know if the tests were done equally in grade schools and in high schools, because high school students, many of them work jobs like in restaurants and things like that, so they are out in the community more. And I also know of cases of special ed students who won't wear or can't wear masks that their parents continue to take them into school even though they're sick. Teachers have gotten COVID from them and given it to family members, and they have lost their family members. They've lost their spouses. So it can get spread in schools. And I'm just wondering, are you testing it, or including more high schools in this study?
Julie, thanks for that question. Dr. Falk.
We had a large population of secondary schools. There were nine in total. And we, again, we were not doing any testing. We were just following the school's report of cases and cases that were thought to be spread in schools. And the any student, according to, you know, kind of the guidelines for each of the districts involved, were excluding any student with any symptom. And they were sent home from school. Some of the schools did have some testing capacity that they were able to swab the students prior to leaving for home, but they would either need to isolate for the 10 days or get tested and show a negative result if it was some other infection. And so, yes, there was equal testing that way. The special ed population is a different population. Interestingly, our study, none of the cases that were contracted within the school involved any of the special ed populations, where obviously there are some difficulties with masking, perhaps. I know in those classrooms, a lot of times teachers in our area are wearing, you know, surgical masks and face shields and other types of protective devices that perhaps, you know, kind of traditional classroom teachers are not doing. And so obviously that varies significantly by school. But yes, students were excluded in the same rate at both high school and elementary schools. And again, of our 7 cases, 5 were contracted in elementary schools among elementary students and only 2 in secondary schools. So we did see less there.
The guidelines from the CDC don't unequivocally say school is safe, just send kids, everything will be fine. It requires layers of work to try to keep kids and all of the staff members safe. What do we need, based on the data that you've seen, Dr. Falk, what do we need in schools to make sure that they do remain places where COVID doesn't spread as much?
I think the most important thing is masking, physical distancing to some extent. There's been much debate on the national level whether 6 feet is needed in the classroom setting. And again, we're going to be looking at that as we bring secondary students back into a full population in the next several weeks, but just to be able to get kids back and out of a hybrid situation. But I think distancing to some degree, masking for sure, proper masking over mouth and nose, and working with children and grownups for that matter to be able to do that. A lot of schools have some level of increased ventilation, whether that's just running the HVAC system for a few hours before and after the school day. And obviously hand hygiene is essential for the mitigation of any virus, especially the coronavirus as well. So I think making sure those things are in place, as well as a really good network of people who are able to help contact trace and help with a lot of the data collection, because I think that's one of the hardest parts for schools as I've worked with them, is just the coordination and logistics of kind of keeping all these moving parts and keeping track of all of them.
Dr. Amy Falk is a pediatrician at Aspirus Doctors Clinic in Wisconsin Rapids, and she's been studying coronavirus transmission rates in schools. We're talking with her here on the Ideas Network, and William in La Crosse is ready to talk with us. Hi, William.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on. This is such a great show, and I'm so thankful to have this researcher on. And we have had our rural school here in person all year long, and I think it's just so important for the kids, and it's good to hear this research that is bearing out what we've seen locally. And I just wonder, with, you know, you were suggesting, Amy, that the masks are so important, and I could see how that would be the case, except in, you know, when the kids are there for 6 hours long, and then, you know, they're touching the masks, they're, you know, the masks are falling down, they're coughing into the masks, they're taking the masks off for snacks and meals and such. It just seems like, do they really need a mask? In, you know, your research has shown that they're not spreading it. And I don't know, I find from what I hear in the schools from people that work there, it doesn't seem like the masks are really making that much of a difference. I'd love to hear why you think they're so important.
Yeah, William, thanks for the question. Dr. Falk.
I think masking, and this is echoed not just in our, you know, relatively small drop in the bucket study regarding the abundant literature of the importance of masking. Interestingly, you know, masking, we got to remember, is just a physical mechanical barrier between your mouth and nose and the environment. And so, yes, if kids are touching their face and if their hands are contaminated, they might inoculate themselves. That's obviously not going to be protective for them. There is some level of protection that a mask gives each person regarding different, you know, basically droplets won't go into your mouth and nose from the environment in such a fashion. And so I think it is important until we learn more about how children transmit this, you know, to what degree they do, that we continue to have them cover their mouth and nose. I have three children. And so I know kids are wonderful maskers. They really are. And we asked a lot of them in the school day to wear a mask all day. But our schools here, for example, in the elementary groups, they're not masking at recess when they're outside. And so they are getting those breaks throughout the day. And my kids really haven't complained a whole lot about that. And obviously, I'm sure it's not perfect, but we do know that it has been at least helpful based on our results and many others.
What about things that we talk about that are just issues in regular education that seem to translate? I'm thinking things like class sizes. I mean, does it change the safety of a situation if you have 25 kids in a class versus 15? What about on-off days or keeping cohorts of teachers and students together so that if infection spreads there, it stays there? What are other things schools need to think about from the health perspective?
That's a really great point. And many of the elementary schools here are cohorted. For example, a class, you know, a first grade class does not intermix with other first grade students or other students or teachers. And then if one student gets infected, they all go out. But I think more is to be learned about the role of distancing within the classroom. I think it is important for schools to, and many schools are doing this, even when distancing is not possible to 6 feet, they will know via assigned seating or other ways to kind of keep track of children and teachers who's close to whom, and then using that to contact trace. For example, Ohio, Missouri, other states are no longer requiring quarantines if you have a close contact within the classroom setting, excuse me. And so just obviously they're monitoring that very carefully. But I think overall, we will likely be learning more about the role that distancing has in the classroom. And I think a lot of people in the country and also internationally are postulating that distancing, especially with perfect mask wearing, is not going to be the essential mitigation measure.
Dr. Falk, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Amy Falk is a pediatrician at Aspirus Doctors Clinic in Wisconsin Rapids. Jill from Kimberly called, said she teaches kindergarten and her kids wear masks well, and they don't have a problem with it. So that's another perspective there wanted to work in. Just ahead is the news. Then we take a deep dive into what education officials say they need to reopen their different school districts around the state. I'm Keely Boltina. Stay with us here on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.